Arrived at Lower Binfield, we sprawled for a long time on the green, watched by cottages from their front gates. A clergyman and his daughter came and stared silently at us for a while, as though we had been aquarium fishers, and then went away again. There were several dozen of us waiting. William and Fred were there, still singing, and the men who had fought, and Bill the Moocher. He'd been mooching from bakers, and had quantities of stale bread tucked away between his coat and his bare body. He shared it out, and we were all glad of it. There was a woman amongst us, the first woman tramp I had ever seen. She was a fattish, battered, very dirty woman of 60, in a long trailing black skirt. She put on great airs of dignity, and if anyone sat down near her, she sniffed and moved further off. "Where you bound for, missus?" one of the tramps called to her. The woman sniffed and looked into the distance. "Come on, missus," he said, "cheer up. Be chummy. We're all in the same boat here."
"Thank you," said the woman bitterly. "When I want to get mixed up with a set of tramps, I'll let you know."
I enjoyed the way she said tramps. It seemed to show you in a flash the whole of her soul, a small, blinkered, feminine soul that had learned absolutely nothing from years on the road. She was, no doubt, a respectable widow woman, become a tramp through some grotesque accident. The spike opened at 6. This was Saturday, and we were to be confined over the weekend, which is the usual practice. Why, I do not know, unless it is from a vague feeling that Sunday merits something disagreeable. When we registered, I gave my trade as journalist. It was truer than painter, for I had sometimes earned money from newspaper articles, but it was a silly thing to say, being bound to lead to questions. As soon as we were inside the spike and had been lined up for the search, the tramp major called my name. He was a stiff, soldierly man of 40, not looking the bully he had been represented, but with an old soldier's gruffness. He said sharply, "Which of you is blank?" I forget what name I had given.
"Me, sir."
"So, you are a journalist?"
"Yes, sir," I said, quaking. A few questions would betray the fact that I had been lying, which might mean prison. But the tramp major only looked me up and down and said,
"Finn, you are a gentleman?"
"I suppose so."
He gave me another long look. "Well, that's bloody bad luck, Governor," he said. "Bloody bad luck, that is."
And thereafter, he treated me with unfair favouritism, and even with a kind of deference. He did not search me, and in the bathroom, he actually gave me a clean towel to myself, an unheard-of luxury. So powerful is the word gentleman in an old soldier's ear. By 7 we had wolfed our bread and tea and were in our cells. We slept one in the cell, and there were bedsteads and straw palliasses, so that one ought to have had a good night's sleep. But no spike is perfect, and the peculiar shortcoming at Lower Binfield was the cold. The hot pipes were not working, and the two blankets we had been given were thin cotton things and almost useless. It was only autumn, but the cold was bitter. One spent the long 12-hour night in turning from side to side, falling asleep for a few minutes and waking up shivering. We could not smoke, for our tobacco, which we had managed to smuggle in, was in our clothes, and we should not get these back till the morning. All down the passage one could hear groaning noises, and sometimes a shouted oath. No one, I imagine, got more than an hour or two of sleep. In the morning, after breakfast and the doctor's inspection, the tramp major herded us all into the dining room and locked the door upon us. It was a lime-washed, stone-floored room, unutterably dreary, with its furniture of deal boards and benches and its prison smell. The barred windows were too high to look out of, and there were no ornaments save a clock and a copy of the workhouse rules. Packed elbow to elbow on the benches, we were bored already, though it was barely 8 in the morning. There was nothing to do, nothing to talk about, not even room to move. The sole consolation was that one could smoke, for smoking was connived at so long as one was not caught in the act. Scotty, a little hairy tramp with a bastard accent sired by Cockney out of Glasgow, was tobaccoless, his tin of cigarette ends having fallen out of his boot during the search and been impounded. I stood him the makings of a cigarette. We smoked furtively, thrusting our cigarettes into our pockets, like schoolboys when we heard the tramp major coming. Most of the tramps spent 10 continuous hours in this comfortless, soulless room. Heaven knows how they put up with it. I was luckier than the others, for at 10 o'clock the tramp major told off a few men for odd jobs, and he picked me out to help in the workhouse kitchen, the most coveted job of all. This, like the clean towel, was a charm worked by the word gentleman. There was no work to do in the kitchen, and I sneaked off into the small shed used for storing potatoes, where some workhouse paupers were skulking to avoid the Sunday morning service. There were comfortable packing cases to sit on, and some back numbers of the Family Herald, and even a copy of Raffles from the workhouse library. The paupers talked interestingly about workhouse life. They told me, among other things, that the thing really hated in the workhouse as a stigma of charity is the uniform. If the men could wear their own clothes or even their own caps and scarves, they would not mind being paupers. I had my dinner from the workhouse table, and it was a meal fit for a boa constrictor, the largest meal I'd eaten since my first day at the Hotel X. The paupers said that they habitually gorged to the bursting point on Sunday and were underfed the rest of the week. After dinner, the cook set me to do the washing up and told me to throw away the food that remained. The wastage was astonishing, and in the circumstances appalling. Half-eaten joints of meat and bucketfuls of broken bread and vegetables were pitched away like so much rubbish, and then defiled with tea leaves. I filled 5 dustbins to overflowing with quite eatable food, and while I did so, 50 tramps were sitting in the spike with their bellies half-filled by the spike dinner of bread and cheese, and perhaps 2 cold boiled potatoes, each in honour of Sunday. According to the paupers, the food was thrown away from deliberate policy rather than that it should be given to the tramps. At 3, I went back to the spike. The tramps had been sitting there since 8, with hardly room to move an elbow, and they were now half mad with boredom. Even smoking was at an end, for a tramp's tobacco is picked up cigarette ends, and he starves if he is more than a few hours away from the pavement. Most of the men were too bored even to talk. They just sat packed on the benches, staring at nothing, their scrubby faces split in 2 by enormous yawns. The room stank of ennui. Paddy, his backside aching from the hard bench, was in a whimpering mood, and to pass the time away I talked with a rather superior tramp, a young carpenter, who wore a collar and tie and was on the road, he said, for lack of a set of tools. He kept a little aloof from the other tramps and held himself more like a free man than a casual. He had literary tastes, too, and carried a copy of Quentin Durward in his pocket. He told me that he never went into a spike unless driven there by hunger, sleeping under hedges and behind ricks in preference. Along the south coast he had begged by day and slept in bathing huts for weeks at a time. We talked of life on the road. He criticised the system that makes a tramp spend 14 hours a day in the spike and the other 10 in walking and dodging the police. He spoke of his own case, 6 months at the public charge for want of a few pounds worth of tools. It was idiotic, he said. Then I told him about the wastage of food in the workhouse kitchen and what I thought of it. And at that he changed his tone instantly. I saw that I had awakened the pew-renter, who sleeps in every English workman. Though he had been famished along with the others, he at once saw reasons why the food should have been thrown away rather than given to the tramps. He admonished me quite severely. "They have to do it," he said. "If they made these places too comfortable, you'd have all the scum of the country flocking into them. It's only the bad food as keeps all that scum away. These here tramps are too lazy to work. That's all that's wrong with them. You don't want to go encouraging of them. They're scum." I produced arguments to prove him wrong, but he would not listen. He kept repeating, "You don't want to have any pity on these here tramps. Scum they are. You don't want to judge them by the same standards as men like you and me. They're scum. Just scum." It was interesting to see the subtle way in which he dissociated himself from "these here tramps." He'd been on the road 6 months, but in the sight of God he seemed to imply he was not a tramp. I imagine there are quite a lot of tramps who thank God they are not tramps. They are like the trippers who say such cutting things about trippers. 3 hours dragged by. At 6, supper arrived, and turned out to be quite uneatable. The bread, tough enough in the morning, it had been cut into slices on Saturday night, was now as hard as ship's biscuit. Luckily it was spread with dripping, and we scraped the dripping off and ate that alone, which was better than nothing. At 6:15 we were sent to bed. New tramps were arriving, and in order not to mix the tramps of different days, for fear of infectious diseases, the new men were put in the cells and we in dormitories. Our dormitory was a barn-like room with 30 beds close together and a tub to serve as a common chamber pot. It stank abominably, and the older men coughed and got up all night. But being so many together kept the room warm, and we had some sleep. We dispersed at 10 in the morning, after a fresh medical inspection, with a hunk of bread and cheese for our midday dinner. William and Fred, strong in the possession of a shilling, impaled their bread on the spike railings as a protest, they said. This was the second spike in Kent that they had made too hot to hold them, and they thought it a great joke. They were cheerful souls for tramps. The imbecile, there is an imbecile in every collection of tramps, said that he was too tired to walk and clung to the railings until the tramp major had to dislodge him and start him with a kick. Paddy and I turned north for London. Most of the others were going on to Ide Hill, said to be about the worst spike in England. Once again it was jolly autumn weather, and the road was quiet, with few cars passing. The air was like sweet briar after the spike's mingled stenches of sweat, soap and drains. We two seemed the only tramps on the road. Then I heard a hurried step behind us, and someone calling. It was little Scotty, the Glasgow tramp, who had run after us, panting. He produced a rusty tin from his pocket. He wore a friendly smile, like someone repaying an obligation.
"Here, mate," he said cordially. "I owe you some faggins. You stood me a smoke yesterday. The tramp major gave me back my box of faggins when we come out this morning. One good turn deserves another. Here you are."
And he put four sodden, debauched, loathly cigarette ends into my hand.